You are now listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast, where the worlds of sports medicine and performance collide. My name is Mike Quintons. I'm a physical therapist with an entrepreneurial mindset that specializes in treating orthopedic and sports injuries. I'm bringing on the brightest and sharpest in the field of sports medicine to share their best practices and explore the gap where medicine meets performance. Today, we are joined by Dr. Steven Sundar. He's a podiatrist at Healthmark Foot and Ankle, currently working out of the Media Springfield and Phoenixville offices. He is a member of the American Podiatric Medical Association and a fellow of the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons. He is board certified in foot surgery, reconstructive rear foot and ankle surgery. Dr. Sundar graduated from Temple University School of Podiatric Medicine and has been published in the Journal of Foot and Ankle Surgery. Dr. Sundar specializes in lower extremity trauma, Charcot foot reconstruction, limb salvage, and ankle arthroscopy, as well as comprehensive scope of forefoot and rear foot medicine. He is a member of the Visitors and Founders Boards at Temple University's School of Podiatric Medicine. I have had the pleasure of collaborating with Dr. Sundar and treating dozens of his patients and especially the athletes. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate being here.
Yeah, I'm also joined by Robert Bina here, as always.
What's up, everybody?
Let's get into this. So, open question, right? Like, tell us a little bit about your practice and, like, what inspired you to be a podiatrist, but what got you to this point?
Sure. Podiatry just kind of fell in my lap. So, what I mean by that, I grew up in Bucks County, so I'm just on the other side of the turnpike here. My parents were fresh off the boat from Trinidad. There was a lot of medicine on my mom's side. My parents both came up here for, like, school and education, better life, you know, the whole normal immigrant kind of story. And there wasn't much of a choice. Like, my mom was a nurse. My dad was a lab guy, like a phlebotomist type of thing. It was either you are doing medicine or you're not doing anything kind of thing. So that's where it went. So I went to Temple for undergrad, knew about podiatry school from that. You know, took my MCATs. They weren't the greatest. And then I was like, all right, well, what do I do? Do I go and do 2 years of that post-bac program and get into even more debt? Or do I see what else is available, right? So knew about the podiatry school. I applied. I got a small scholarship. I knew I could do surgery. So I kind of just rolled with it there. And I said, you know, if it doesn't work, then I can always figure it out at the end. But then did well there and got the residency program I wanted. And here we go. So when I first came out, I worked up that way. Like, so my residency program was in, it's now like Jefferson, Frankfurt, or whatever. So right. It was Frankfurt Hospital, Jefferson Health when I was there. Then it became Aria, and now it's bought over again by Jefferson. Jefferson, Bucks, Torsdale, and Old Frankfurt. And so we were right off of 95. We saw every foot and ankle trauma possible. And what was really nice, the main attending that I worked under, he didn't have any fellows at the time. So he was literally getting like 90% of all the foot and ankle trauma. So we did trauma all day, every day, all the recons. And then your normal bunions, hammer toes with the group of docs. We had about 15 docs that we would work with on a regular basis. So we literally just lived at the hospital and then got a job out there, just didn't work out, and then ended up coming out this way through a couple of different moves, ended up with Romansky and Healthmark and our whole crew here. Been here, it'll be 6 years in February.
Wow, man, I remember when you first came on, we had dinner together.
Right.
Yeah. I was like, oh, it's 6 years already.
6 years already. Yeah, it's wild. So there's five of us in the group, Romansky, Erfel, Flannery, myself, and Rice. And then there's four offices. We each kind of go to three out of the four offices between Exton, Springfield, Media, and Phoenixville.
Awesome, man. So with your fellowship, real quick, dive into this. You saw complex stuff.
So traumas, it was residency.
Residency.
Yeah. But we saw everything from motor vehicle accidents, to boating accidents, to gunshot wounds, to just regular athletic traumas. We did, because we were right by the Philadelphia racetrack, so we would see jockeys, right? We would see college athletes, like you name it, we did it.
It was wild.
That's
got to be a rush. All right, let's dive. I got a handful of questions here I want to get through. Sure. High ankle sprains, right? So everyone always has like the dreaded high ankle sprain, right? So what is the typical mechanism of injury? And tell us a little bit about like what is being damaged in a high ankle sprain.
So it's the same kind of mechanism as like a regular ankle sprain, right? It's an inversion injury. So your foot rolls inwards and your ankle and leg kind of roll outward, right? So a normal ankle sprain, so the way the ankle is made up, you have your inside leg bone, which is your tibia, you have your outside leg bone, your fibula, and deep is your actual ankle bone. And then there's four ligaments on the inside, three ligaments on the outside. When you roll on a normal ankle sprain, you usually damage the outside ligaments, and the one in the front is the one that gets damaged the most because it's the weakest. A high ankle sprain is when the ligament above that level gets injured. So you have the four on the inside of the ankle, the three on the outside, and then the tib and the fib are held together by a ligament called the syndesmosis. So when you get a high ankle sprain, that's what tends to get damaged. And that is a longer recovery because it's more unstable. The ankle's more unstable. Your more ligaments are involved. There's more bony bruising, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, typically, and I think this is kind of my own little algorithm, so to speak. So anytime we're dealing with like bone or soft tissue injuries, you'll hear whatever professional on the news, media, whatever say, you know, it takes bone like 4 to 6 weeks to heal. It takes ligaments maybe a little more than that. I always say it's 6 to 8 weeks for bone and double that for soft tissue, whether that's ligament, tendon, or just, you know, sprains in general, right? So when we're talking like a high ankle sprain, like you're not going to see decent improvement till 3, maybe 4 months where you start saying, oh, I wake up and I don't feel that bad of an injury. Like I could feel like I can get through my day a little bit better. But with anything, whether it's bone, soft tissue, or surgical or non-surgical, right? I always tell the patients, you know, it's a full year recovery. Whatever you're doing, it's going to take a full year for you to get back to where you were before. It's going to take a full year for you to get to your new normal. And if we're talking about something where you're immobilized for a long period of time, I always start clock zero once you get out of that immobilization. And that's the way I try to explain it to patients so that I'm trying to manage their expectations.
That's the game, man. Yeah. That is the game. Managing expectations, what's realistic and what's not.
Right.
And I'd rather overshoot it than, you know, shortchange it and then not come back to bite you.
Because everybody thinks they heal faster than they do. And we just don't. Like our body just doesn't do that unless you're like Tio. Right. Back in the day, or like somebody who's just a freak of nature.
So when someone rolls their ankle and they have, you know, that softball on the outside of their ankle or on the inside of their ankle, that's different, right? Would you expect that's a lower ankle sprain? Would you expect any kind of swelling like that with a high ankle sprain?
You can, yeah, because it's all, you know, it's all the same mechanism. It's just a matter of patient, what they were doing, how they rolled it, what they were wearing, what kind of body habitus they are, you know, so all of that can get taken into account. Or has to get taken into account, sure. You know, and you don't truly know that it's a high ankle sprain unless you get an MRI, right? So if you see them in the office, first of all, they're painful, they're guarded. So you can have the idea, okay, you have an ankle sprain. You don't necessarily know how high it is. There are some in-office tests you can do depending on how tender they are.
Right. So we have special tests, right? And so
anterior draw test is where you're trying to translate the talus, the actual ankle bone, right? So that tests the integrity of your ATFL. And then if you do like a proximal squeeze test, so like you squeeze the tib and the fib above the ankle joint and you get pain down at the ankle, that usually constitutes that's that high fibular sprain.
Right.
Right. And then if you do something called a Taylor tilt, where you're rotating essentially the heel and the ankle and you're separating that lateral structures, that also helps you with just kind of designating sprain or what.
So like, just so our listeners understand, like everything above the ankle has to be very forgiving because the ankle joint can be very stiff, right?
And so
you need mobility and rotation at those lower two bones, right? Your tibia and your fibula. And when you have a piece of tissue, essentially, that's relatively, how thick is it? I forget, from cadaver lab.
Yeah.
It's not like a tissue.
It's not a tissue. It's thick, but it's not as thick as like the Achilles tendon or anything like that. You know?
Right. And so it can be relatively easily damaged, but it needs to be forgiving. It needs to be able to gap and then come together. And and so that's why it can be, I think that's a component as to why it can be so long to heal, and especially return to sport where you're cutting, changing direction, where that ankle is, yes, it's stable, but stiff. You may need some extra motion out of that tib-fib joint.
And I think a lot of it too is when you get to that higher ankle sprain, you know, the majority of the other ligaments are also damaged. So now, It's not only the syndesmosis that gets injured.
Yeah. And so the MRI is the gold standard to diagnose?
For that, I mean, that's what we do in our practice. I mean, I guess people can do like a CT with a soft tissue window or ultrasound, but MRI is our way.
Okay. And then the course of like a return, so are that you boot them 6 to 8 weeks? Is that usually longer than that?
It depends.
Are you monitoring like every couple weeks?
Monitoring every couple weeks. Again, taking into account their activity level, their body habitus, all that stuff. But they're definitely booted for about, say, 3 to 4 weeks. And depending on how that goes, start to transition to an ankle brace. If they're still hurting, keep them in the boot for closer to 8 weeks and then still transition to an ankle brace. And then figure out some kind of PT, I personally wouldn't necessarily start until like 6 weeks, but not really doing a lot of stuff, like just kind of gentle motions, get some strength going and trying just not to have them get so tight and so stiff.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. In terms of an ankle brace, do you have any recommendations? I feel like the number of times I get asked, I'm sure you too, Rob.
Yeah, that was one question I definitely had for you. It was like
we use one in the office called a BioSkin. What's nice about it, it's two parts. So it's like a compression sleeve that goes on, and then there's a wrap. So you can use it two ways. You know, if the certain shoes don't fit it, the two parts, then at least you have the one part. That's nice because it does give you a little bit of compression. But any of the like double upright ankle foot orthoses, the AFOs kind of things, like where you have the wraps and the ties, I think are way better than your white and green Aircast. I never understood that. I still don't understand that. I think that is a joke of something to help give you stability.
Please tell me, I agree with you, but I want to hear your reasoning as to why. Like, why are you anti-Softcat, not the anti-
The Aircast. So I guess part of the reason why I even got into podiatry was I was super injury prone growing up and like broke both ankles, non-surgical, rolled ankles all the time, constantly roll my ankle now because I need like a lateral ankle stabilization. And every time I would go to and my mom was actually a nurse at Frankfurt. So it's like, she was like one of the ortho nurses. So the ortho docs knew me by name because I was always in there. And the minute you go to the ED, you get the Aircast, right? And then you go to the office and they're like, all right, this was before like boots were as popular as they were, right?
Yeah.
And that stupid thing just would slide everywhere. Like your foot and your ankle is just dangling in it. Like it just wasn't comfortable. I don't feel like it gave you any support. Just like a plain ace wrap doesn't give you any support. So I just never appreciated them.
It's like two fixed upright,
like plastic
pieces. And
with like a weird air pocket and like a stupid little sling on the bottom that captures your heel.
And it was like plastic, so your foot would slide in it all the time. I remember I wore that in eighth grade. I smoked my ankle and I tried to play on it. My foot was sliding on it. It was falling. It was a disaster.
Right. Yeah. Even if you put that in your sneaker, like a high top or whatever, you're still sliding it.
Doesn't matter.
No matter how tight you put that Velcro around your ankle, the rest of your leg.
So how about like tape? Because we have a lot of athletes that listen now. How do you feel about like tape in the ankle or even like called spatting, like over the cleats?
Yeah, so I like over the cleats a lot because I feel like it's almost like locking you in like a ski boot kind of. Tape, as we all know, tape lasts, 10 to 15 minutes is what you get of actual
the tension of it.
Yeah. Yeah. But in high school, I would get my ankles taped every time I played. So I feel like from a mental standpoint, it gives you that little extra stability. And then if you're playing a sport and you have a high top cleat or a mid and you have a little extra, then if you do the over the cleat taping, I think all of that is helpful. And it's obviously, it's bulky, but it's less bulky than a lace-up brace with ties and wraps and all that.
So I want to make sure our listeners understand this just as maybe a liability issue. Like, have it taped by a professional, please. Don't like YouTube a video and tape it up, because the number of times we've seen athletes come into our clinics with tape on their wrist or ankle, and then they're losing straight, like you're starting to lose circulation into their distal phalanges or fingers or toes. Like that can be a problem. So make sure a professional is doing that before you just start taping on ankle. Right.
Very good point.
How are those braces different? Like I played basketball a lot, and like we just had this brace that would loop tie tight, kind of went underneath the heel. Is that the same thing you guys are talking about?
You're talking about something different.
That's different than what you guys are talking about.
That's the one that I think you like. Right,
if it's what I'm thinking of, it's a little like it's less bulky,
kind of like under the heel,
Yeah. So that one's not too bad. It's
kind of like a shoe.
Yeah,
like it's kind of like a shoe comes up to like maybe
like right above the malleolus.
Yeah.
Those aren't too bad because they're definitely less bulky. And if you don't feel that,
it wasn't very bulky. I remember.
If you feel like you just need something for a little extra stability, I think those are decent. I'll even transition people from boot to bulky brace to like just the Ace Elastic sleeves. Mm-hmm. You ever see those? Yeah. Just because it gives you a little compression, and it just, for me, helps me sleep a little bit better. And I know like, all right, I have something on, because you're not necessarily, you're healed right at this point, right? You're stronger. Everything's good. You're still prone to rolling, but we're prone to rolling regardless, right? But it just gives you that little bit extra. So sometimes you don't need so much of a stabilizer.
Is like there research that looks at people that wear braces and people that don't wear braces post an injury? Like, are they more likely to happen again if they aren't wearing a brace, or if they are wearing a brace?
How effective is the brace, I guess?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, that's a good question.
I would imagine there is. I don't know anything off the top of my head, but I would imagine there's something. And I would probably guess that if you've had an injury and then you try to get back to that same activity without a brace, you're probably going to be more prone to injury. re-injuring.
Right, sure. Without it. Right. Without, yeah, that's what I was getting at. Like, it's probably, like, is that something you recommend somebody have? They have a high ankle sprain. They're coming back to sport. Are you like, hey, like, I'd probably recommend you go and get a brace and wear it during your basketball or football or whatever sport.
Yeah.
So everybody, you're recommending the brace.
And okay. if it's not the bulky one, it's that elastic sleeve.
Now, what are like the, what do you think the most common sports are that have
basketball high ankle sprains? Sure. See a lot in football players, lacrosse, and then we say soccer. I think those are probably the biggest ones.
Yeah, I would think like cleats, change of direction, high force, right? Impact, yeah. Like field hockey, probably not too
field
much.
Field hockey, that's true. That's a good point. Like, no. Field hockey.
Do you think, yeah? Yeah, okay, there you go. Yeah, maybe.
Hockey, yeah.
Yeah, basketball's tough because you like land on somebody else's right, foot. Right. So that makes it, I feel like, more common than like your cutting sports.
Yeah.
I would agree.
How long do you typically recommend a brace? Like in that, for like sports, for example, right? Like after they've returned the play, they've been cleared.
Yeah. So then I'll have them kind of do it for, let's use like 2 months, as they've been in a boot for 2 months. And then they're using the ankle brace, trying to get back to strength and doing PT for about a month.
Yep.
And then now we're 3 months post injury. So like month four through six, I would say use it.
Yeah.
Only for sporting stuff, like not necessarily day-to-day stuff.
That's a great point.
And then during that month 4 to 6, they can kind of see, you know, test the waters a little bit, right? And then they can either go to like a much lighter brace, or if they have just a solid shoe, and sometimes if they have like more of like the high or the mid, they don't necessarily need it. So I think it comes down a lot to shoe gear and what activity they're doing.
More of like, I guess, an anatomy question. Like the laxity that occurs with an ATFL sprain or a lateral ankle sprain, it's never the same, right? Like at least that's what we're taught, right? It's never the same. Is that the case with high ankle? Is it ever the same?
Can it actually fully heal? Like you're not getting a high ankle without the lateral ankle, right?
That's
so
fair.
Yeah. So once, what I always say, whether it's ligament or tendon, the fibers prior to injury are always tight. And once they get injured, they heal, but they heal elongated, they heal thickened, you get scarring, and they're not as tight. So you're not as strong as what you were before, regardless of PT and whatever, right?
Sure.
So it doesn't mean that you're necessarily prone to re-injury. It just means that you're more unstable than you were before the injury.
Right? Gotcha. That makes perfect sense. And like you said, it's never just an isolated high ankle, right? Like you're going to have other components of that injury. Correct. Question for you, Rob. You train athletes, high level, high school, middle school. How do you try to mitigate the risk of these types of injuries?
Yeah, I feel like the ankle injuries are always tough. I always come back down to like, you have to train lots of single leg exercises that are placing people on one foot and getting them to control different movements. So like we'll have them do single leg RDLs, lunging variations, you know, doing more single leg exercises. I feel like under load is an important thing to do. And then doing lots of dynamic movements, single leg hopping, forward, lateral, you know, really challenging them through different positions through a dynamic movement, I feel like are important. And then making sure your training changes direction, right? Like getting them at game speed, changing direction, cutting. You know, the more you can prepare the tissues for game-like environments, the better. Can I help someone if they land on somebody's foot? Probably not. So I feel like those are some big concepts. I feel like there's another concept out there. This might be testing some things here, but I don't do a ton of it. Like to, you can open this up to get some thoughts, but like placing the ankle like almost turned out on its side and doing whatever exercise you want to do, standing on one leg, lunge position, iso hold, where we're like training that position, that tissue to be responsive to that, instead of just doing everything with the foot flat in contact with the ground, where we're putting it in that position, training it, being more comfortable there. I don't do a ton of it, but I've seen a lot of people that do that. Concepts are like, you know, let's prepare the body for the positions that we're getting in, that we're getting injured in. If the tissues aren't ever there or aren't ever loaded in that position, how are they going to be, you know, and when they get there on their load, when they roll, they're then prepared for that load.
That's interesting.
Interesting concept. Yeah. I don't do a ton of it, but love to get your guys' thoughts on that.
How do you do that on a wedge?
Abs board.
There's a lot of progressions I feel like you can go with this, right? Like I'm not saying like, hey, go stand on the outside of your foot and do a goblet squat. You know, that's like the cool thing that you might see on Instagram. I feel like there's a lot of early progressions where you can like get somebody standing on the outside of their foot, standing on one leg, holding a light dumbbell, and have them hold that position. You know, I feel like the wedge on the inside of the arch might help just like for some proprioception so that they can come back to the wedge so they're not just holding that end range. But it's just like training end range of ankle positions.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I I like it. I think it's got to fit the, it's got to be appropriate for that individual, right? Like if that's, if that person's coming off a lateral ankle sprain, probably not, right? Like let's not load that in that position, right? Or at least be very conservative in how you're going to do that. Maybe a very narrow or like, you know, low angled wedge of some kind. But like to load that in a static position like that is, that's an interesting thought, because then you're loading the peroneals, right? You're loading all the lateral ankle structures that would have to be reactive, but it's in a different manner, right? You're doing it more, maybe slightly static, you know, more static.
Right. Yeah.
Than dynamic.
I think you would definitely start more static and then, progress to more dynamic movements like a squat or a lunge.
Reduce the risk of
et cetera.
Irritation. Then I think it sounds good on paper, but that's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
What do you think of that, Doc?
Yeah. Never thought about training that way, but it does make sense. Like you're training for the bad thing that's going to happen, right? So if your body doesn't know what to expect, but now you're trying to make it understand what to expect, that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, would you load a pitcher shoulder at end range rotation?
Right. Yeah.
Right.
It's
an interesting thought, right? Because there's a lot of stress on the ligaments in that position too. But interesting. Is there anything that you know of, Doc, that like can help to mitigate the risk of these types of injuries, right? Like I feel like I asked a couple of patients that told me you were coming in, and I was like, what questions do you have? Like, how do I prevent this from happening?
Yeah. I think a lot of it is issue gear, right? So making sure you're wearing the appropriate stuff for what you're playing. You're not going for a run in Chuck Taylors, right? You're not playing basketball with a pair of Crocs, like those kind of things, I think. And I say that
because real talk.
It's happened, right? Right? You know, like you're out there, you're shooting ball with your 10-year-old and you got a pair of slides on and you're just goofing around. You're like, I'm just going to take a couple shots. And next thing you know, you go up for a board because you think you're whatever, and you roll it and you're like, why did I do that? You know? So I think shoe gear comes down to a big part of it. And I think if you have had that injury, you just need to be cognizant of, all right, maybe I just brace up, and almost like your theory of the way you're strengthening it, like you're using the brace to prevent it from happening again, right? You look at all these basketball players, NFL stars, right? They've had knees and elbows and things done and surgically repaired, and they're healed and they're back at it, but they're still using that brace to prevent it from re-injuring, right? I kind of look at the brace the same way, or using some kind of tape or something like that same way to just give a little extra stability so you can try to head it off before it reoccurs.
Yeah. Love it. I think that some degree of intelligence in footwear and in situations, I think this is very important.
Last question, I think, on the high ankle sprains.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the taping and the chronic wearing of ankle braces, chronic years, multiple years, so like let's say you're getting to like a college or like a professional player, leads to potentially some, like, I'll just use the word atrophy, or like destabilization of like some of the muscles around the ankle? Does that like take away from some of the natural stability components, like in the muscles or the ligaments?
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. That's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of people feel like you get dependent on the brace or the tape, and you're using it like a crutch, right? And I get that. I totally get that. And I think there is some truth to, there is some atrophy because you're using these things to help prevent an injury from occurring. But I feel like the flip side of that is it's already been damaged once. It's not as strong as what it was originally. I don't want to get it re-injured, right? So like if I feel like, oh, I feel good, I feel strong, and I go out and I re-injure again, now it's damaged twice. And now it's even weaker the second time around, right? So I feel like using something along those lines to prevent it is, in my mind, a better option than just going and being like, oh, I rolled the same ankle again.
Six ankle
months,
sprains.
Yeah, right. Six months later.
I've seen those people where they come in.
I rolled your ankle. Person.
Oh, yeah. 10 plus times.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So I think I'd rather error it. I always try to explain it like, think of the brace as like glasses or contacts, right? You can't, you're already, your vision's down already. This is what's helping. Doesn't correct it. It helps to supplement it, right? This is what the brace is doing. It's helping to give you what you need to get through what you got to get.
No, that's awesome. I'm happy. I think you nailed that. Are you getting an MRI post
so
to confirm?
That's a great question. That's a great thought. So say individual came in, I'll boot them, get x-rays, do my exam, boot them, come back in about 2 weeks. My threshold's 2 weeks. Come back in 2 weeks. If they're still kind of hurting, if they're not really getting that much better, between that 2 to 4 week mark, I'll pull the trigger to get the MRI. Some docs will do it that same day. If they have a history of injuries, right? So like they've seen a couple other docs, they've injured this ankle before, they're seeing me for another opinion, then right off the bat, I'll get the MRI.
Okay.
So yeah. I think it's kind of like patient and scenario dependent.
But post like clearance, return to PT, like you don't need an MRI.
Repeat? Not usually. You
get a repeat MRI? Okay. Yeah. Because it's not like you're looking for much of a change other than maybe some
just some scarring and some healing there. But a lot of it is the in-office manipulation, right? So like a negative anterior draw, a negative proximal squeeze test. They feel stable. You're putting them through tailor till, like all that stuff. And they feel good without any pain. Yeah. And their strength is better, you know.
Awesome. Let's dive into Achilles tendons.
Okay.
All right. Achilles tendons, hot topic right now. Obviously, we're seeing like a lot of them in, you know, this NFL season.
I feel like
there's been
normal. Like four or five, right?
You know, like Phillips went down, the DN for Miami. You had Rodgers, obviously.
Cousins,
that's right.
There was another quarterback, I thought, or another big time player flew it out.
I thought there was one more, like a receiver. Yeah. But nonetheless, what is the typical mechanism of injury for an Achilles tendon rupture?
Yeah. So it's force, right? It's not a roll. It's not anything like that. It's like a forceful dorsiflexion of the foot and the ankle. But usually their Achilles is already tight, right? So you have a tight gastroc, you have a tight Achilles, maybe you have a heel spur of some sort on the back of the heel. And you push off funny, so you're pushing off and that ankle's flexing, and then you just feel it go. Occasionally, you'll get the like planted foot in that position and somebody roll into you and you blow it out, but it's usually that just kind of you're pushing off, you're trying to actively run like quickly, and then it just goes on you.
So the Achilles is like the way we, you know, as humans move and change direction and be explosive as we take like a drop step sometimes, right? So it's almost like that rapid, just so like you guys can have visual or listeners. It's like that rapid like spring load where the heel comes down and explodes out. And during the way down, typically is when we see that rupture. Like at the very bottom of that, where that's where you have the most, that's like where the spring is like coiled up and ready to be forceful going out. That's when we tend to see it. And you see that snap in the gastroc. Yeah. What is that just for our listeners so they can understand like what they see?
So if, you know, that, if we're trying to put it to what we can experience right now. So like if you looked at that Aaron Rodgers game that I get when he was playing with the Jets, that play, right? You saw him kind of do what you're just talking about, like the drop step or whatever. And as he pushed off, you see his sock like kind of bunch up, right? So what's bunching up? It's one of two things. It's either the Achilles itself, right? Partially tearing or completely rupturing. I guess one of three things, partially rupturing or completely rupturing, or it could be the Achilles pulling off of the back of the heel. So you're pulling part of the heel bone with you. And that's more of an avulsion fracture where the Achilles is still intact. Or there's a small tendon on the outside or around the Achilles called the plantaris. That's a smaller one that could be rupturing. That's less involved and usually doesn't need any type of repair, but the other two do.
How long till surgery? Right. And does everyone need surgery?
As quick as possible. And no, everybody does not need surgery in the sense of, you know, if you have like I had an 85-year-old guy who was playing golf who ruptured it in like the summer. And then he came to me in like the fall and he's like, yeah, I can't really walk. I have this like slapping gait. I'm like, yeah, man, you're 85. Like there's no reason for me to open that up and repair that. So like there's certain people where you kind of let them fly and you could boot them and, like a plantar flex position. So you put wedges in the heel and try to let that gap close in as best it can, or you can cast them that way. Like there's definitely certain people, certain, again, body habitus, things like that, health, a bad diabetic, a chronic smoker, like things like that, where you're like, you know what, we're just going to treat it conservatively and you're going to be a little weaker, but you'll be okay. And worst case scenario, if we need to, we can always go back and fix it somehow, right? If you're younger, healthy, not even if you're an athlete, but you're a weekend warrior or you just stepped awkwardly like playing soccer in the backyard with your kid, that's the person that once that's ruptured, you get, you know, they come in, get an MRI, see how big the gap is, see what you're dealing with. Are we dealing with the straight tendon or are we dealing with the tendon and the bone? And then you have your game plan and then, you know, you want to fix that sooner than later.
And the reason for this sooner than later is because the two ends of the tendon or, you know, the two points you want to attach back together, there's issues with that, right? Over time.
There's issues with that. The tendon gets tighter. There's just a lot of scarring that's involved. That area where you have to go in to make your incision is difficult to heal in general because of the blood supply. So, you know, you want to take all those things into consideration. So the sooner you can get to it, the better it is for the patient.
How do you guys manage these types of injuries with higher level athletes, right? Like, so your Aaron Rodgers case, for example, right? Like they're getting surgery as soon as possible, right? And then they're non-weight bearing for a certain period of time. Is that how it usually works?
Yeah. And, you know, your college athletes, your professional athletes, they obviously have everything at their fingertips. So like it happens now and 2 minutes later, they're getting an MRI, you know, and the next day they're going on the OR table. So we don't have that privilege, right? We're waiting to get the MRI. We're waiting to get on the OR schedule. But a lot of times you're getting it done within a week to 10 days.
Are they not weight bearing? Okay.
You
know, so how long is that for? When are they going to get back to walking? What's the progression of their recovery?
And I think I do mine a little bit more conservatively. Like I usually take my stitches out in about 3 weeks. So I have them immobilized for 3 weeks with a dressing. Once the stitches come out, then I start to transition them to maybe a boot, not necessarily weight bearing. And I keep them non weight bearing for about 6 weeks. I know colleagues who weight bear them 2 weeks. I have colleagues who weight bear them 12 weeks. So I think there's a lot of play with what you're comfortable with. But I'll tell you what's been a game changer is, as you and I have spoke about before, is the Alter G, because you can get them moving so much faster at their lesser body weight percentage. Yep. So you're not as stiff. Like we're not looking for, you know, trying to have it re-rupture because that tendon and everything is still trying to heal. But I think just getting them moving and getting them in the act of jogging, walking, running, like is huge early on.
So just so our listeners understand that the ankle joint is in a fixed position for a long period of time, right? So you're not, the angle between your toes and your shin, like that angle stays the same for a period of time and that needs to change, right? Like that you can't function that way. So once you've been non-weight bearing for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 12 weeks, that joint can get really stiff. And so when that person goes to walk, you know, their shin bone isn't going over their toes as they're walking, right? As they squat down, that shin bone isn't coming forward over the toes. So I think what people need to understand is that the joint itself, forget the Achilles, the joint itself can be so stiff and restricted that can limit the ability of the Achilles to actually tolerate a load, right, or vice versa. So I think it's important for people to understand that getting them in a Alter G that takes essentially, it's a treadmill that takes away up to 80% of your body weight, can help that person learn how to walk again, so to speak, and help that tendon take some load on and that ankle go through some range of motion while minimizing risk. So at what point are they doing more aggressive activities? Like, are they like in terms of jogging, walking, like out of the treadmill? And I'm sure it's different for different people.
Yeah, I think it's different for different people. But like I would say, you know, they're not doing jogging, box jumps, lateral motions, start stops, probably for 4 to 6 months, depending.
Yeah.
Professional athletes are different because they have literally everything at their fingertips. So they can go to PT, they can get shockwave, they can get ultrasound, they can do whatever on a daily basis, right? They can do hyperbaric oxygen and all that helps.
Yeah. Laser.
We can't. You know, they're getting PRP or amnio injections in there as well. And, you know, we don't always have that luxury, you know?
Yep.
So, you know, and it's funny because I'm sure you guys see it too, where somebody will come in, they have an injury. They're like, oh, I just had this injury, like whoever, professional. And you're like, but they're already back. We're the same age. And you're like, yeah, well, you know, they also make, you know, 20 million times more money than what you make. And it's just a different avenue.
Yeah. A lot of these resources you're talking about aren't covered by insurance. Right.
Right. Right. Exactly.
All right. So tell me a little bit about some of the research out there that for Achilles repairs, well, not repairs, but Achilles, managing Achilles conservatively. Right. So like you said, you can have the heel lifted. I'm seeing more and more of that in the research.
Yeah. So you can cast them in like a slightly plantar flex position and you redo that cast like every week, each week, trying to slowly get them back up to 90 degrees. And the same situation can occur with a boot. There's wedges that you can put in a boot, or there's, I forget the name of the actual boot, but there's one boot that you can actually dial in the degrees every week or every 2 weeks.
So you get an objective angle on it.
Right. So interesting. Those are kind of the two ways.
All right. And then you're just managing the healing process at that point, overseeing it every few weeks.
Yeah.
Imaging on that.
Imaging, like once you get your initial x-ray and your MRI, you kind of know what you're dealing with. So it's a lot of just in-office palpation, right? So you'll feel that gap right off the bat. And then eventually you'll start feeling more continuity of the tendon on either side. And then because it will bridge, it'll scar in for the most part. It's not going to be as strong. You might always have some like slapping gait, like a little weakness there. You're not going to have that push off strength. but you'll feel it over time kind of scar in.
Yeah. Like what's the alternative? Like you go under the knife.
Yeah. Right.
Or like, and I'm sure you would see improvements in strength with that as well.
Right. And look, just as we all know, like surgery is not an end all be all, right? Like it's successful. If it wasn't successful, we wouldn't be in the mode to treat these things surgically. Right. But you figure everything's about 85% success rate. So there's always that 15% chance of bad things happening. It doesn't heal appropriately. You get an infection, you dehisce whatever, the tendon blows out again. Like there's always risk to doing something surgical. But with individuals who meet the criteria, the appropriate criteria, you want to try to fix those as opposed to treat it conservatively for better long-term results.
So let's get into Rodgers' recovery. Yeah. So everyone's making a big, you know, fuss about him, you know, already throwing the ball. He's, you know, participating in individual drills.
He's coming back, Mike.
He's coming back. Yeah. I think if they were like in a playoff situation, I think he probably would within the next few weeks. I mean, it seems like he's getting around pretty well, but I don't know, to do it twice in that short a period of time. I mean, you would know depending on how they fixated it and where it was fixated.
Yeah. So you mentioned to me earlier. So if it was a straight like end-to-end repair, so whenever you have a rupture, whether it's a full or a partial, and you can repair it end-to-end and you're able to get everything back with just suture, that's probably ideal, the most ideal, right?
Like a mid-tendon?
A mid-tendon rupture, okay. Right? Or partial rupture. If you have to lengthen, because you can always lengthen the tendon, you just make a larger incision, lengthen the gastroc, and then get yourself some length that way and repair it. Sometimes you have to take like one of the flexor tendons and reroute that and repair it. Or sometimes you can repair it end to end and then wrap it with like a tissue graft of some sort just to kind of augment it, right? So those are your end to end types of ways to do it. And there's all sorts of different suture techniques and whatever. Back when Ryan Howard blew out his, he had a percutaneous repair done. So what that means is they didn't make a big incision. They made a smaller incision, put a bunch of different needles through the tendon above and below the rupture, and then fixed it that way. That system's still out. A lot of people do use that. I've never been a fan of it because I feel like you're going in blind and you can bag nerves and you're not always getting the bulk of the tendon. But there's people that love it and they do well with it, and, yeah, and that's fine. Like that's why it's practice, right? You do what you're kind of comfortable with. So those are kind of the two ways to repair a mid-substance tear. If what you're saying is what happened to Rodgers where he actually avulsed the calcaneus, the back of the heel, then that's actually a little bit easier because the tendon's intact. So now you're just reattaching the attachment point of the tendon, right? So you can make a smaller incision or now they have a system where you can just do it through stab incisions and you're basically just anchoring that bone down and reattaching and creating a suture bridge to hold that tendon back in place. So that's a little bit easier of a recovery. Like he's probably walking at 6 weeks with that and he's trying to rehab. I don't know how strong he's going to be. I don't know how much push off he's going to be. I mean, he goes back to what I said, you know, it takes our body really a full year to recover from that stuff. You know, if you go back and you look at a lot of these big time athletes who've blown out Achilles, right? So like Kevin Durant, Kobe yeah, right?
Yeah.
Thompson.
That's his name from the Warriors.
Klay Thompson.
Klay Thompson, right? You know, even Jason Peters, right, back in the day.
That's
like,
right.
These guys can come back. They'll come back and they feel strong, but you notice other things start breaking down, right? And it's usually the contralateral side. So they blew out their left Achilles, their right knee starts bothering.
Klay Thompson.
Right? They blew out your left Achilles, your hips bother you, your other ankles bother you, and then you're just weaker, and then you just body just starts deteriorating. It's the biggest tendon in your body, right? And then when that's that weak and when that's had damage, even if you give it that full year recovery, other things do tend to break down.
It's fascinating. Interesting stuff. And you see it in the explosive, like I call them like the functionally stiff athletes. Like there's no way Kevin Durant's got a 90-90 like hip flexion and a straight leg raise, right? Like there's no way. So like those types of like fast twitch, like stiff, but like explosive athletes, I think is what, not like the pliable ones, right? Like, I think you see that the more stiff ones end up with this kind of injury just because there's so much force,
right,
that is transduced through a very quick, shortened motion. And it's, you know, that's how you rupture it. So like your fast twitch. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you feel like you've seen a lot of Achilles tendonitis and then they have a rupture?
Right.
So is that usually like how it progresses?
It's usually how it progresses.
Or some calf tightness. Like what's like warning signs, right? That like we see somebody here and they're like, they always have calf tightness or they've had Achilles tendonitis or, you know, what are some warning signs that you see in athletes that then would go on and have an Achilles?
Yeah. So I think you kind of hit the nail on the head right there. So you have somebody who's always tight, gastroc tightness, Achilles tightness. You have somebody who has even, you know, some inflammation or thickening around the Achilles, like at that watershed area, that mid substance area. You have some pain at that the myotendinous junction, like where the muscle meets the tendon, or you have pain where the Achilles actually inserts, right? So it doesn't have to be pain all the time. It just has to be like, oh, you know what, when I wear a certain pair of shoes or when I'm on my feet for a while, we're going along with gardens and we're walking for 3 hours, like my Achilles starts bothering me. Like those are kind of precursors to, all right, if you're not stretching, if you're not doing the right thing, watching what you're wearing, shoes, alternating, all that stuff, that if you go out one day and decide, all right, I haven't done anything athletic in months, now I'm going to go and throw a football or I'm going to go shoot some baskets. That's what
dunk a ball on an 8 foot rim. Yeah,
you're going to blow out your Achilles 9 out of 10 times probably.
Would you lump like plantar fasciitis into that?
Yes, no. You know, there are some studies that say the end or inferior fibers of the Achilles tendon come around and create the originating fibers of the plantar fascia. So there is some connection there, right? And if you go back and depending on what your beliefs are, right? Like if our foot was, you know, straight, so to speak, like we're not at that 90 degree angle, like you could see like that Achilles and that fascia like being continuous, right? So it depends on what you think there. But I don't think there's a big relation between having plantar fasciitis and blowing out your Achilles.
How about like from like an arch standpoint, do you feel like you see a lot of people that have that injury that have like a lower arch or like a flatter foot, or do you feel like they're more like out on the outside of their foot?
Personally, I think it's more of a flatter foot. I think a flatter foot tends to have a tighter Achilles and they tend to be more prone. However, like a very rigid high arch or cavus foot has a super tight Achilles as well. But I think just they don't have that push off force. So they don't necessarily see a lot of Achilles ruptures, where I think flat foots definitely do see more.
Mechanically, it would make sense, but they may not be able to generate enough force
right to
cause that kind of a rupture. Yeah.
Because, I mean, take the couple people we just talked about. So, like, Ryan Howard, flatfoot, Kevin Durant, flatfoot, Jason Peters, flatfoot. Like, all those guys are just big dudes.
Flatfoot. Makes sense. What else you got on this?
Do you feel like a limited ankle, like, if someone's living in dorsiflexion, is that going to also affect this injury from happening? Like, someone's living in dorsiflexion, they go to push off, and they don't have the dorsiflexion in the front of the ankle. It's like trying to pick up range of motion elsewhere and it picks it up from rupturing.
I think so. Yeah, I do. Because they're trying to force an issue kind of, right? And then something's got to give. And usually that Achilles is tight and that's what goes.
I think the force with that, right? Mm-hmm. So the lack of dorsiflexion with a high amount of force into a rapid dorsiflexion, right? Like that makes sense to me that if there was, you know, especially if there's an asymmetry between the two sides, right? Like I would consider that to be a risk factor.
Do you feel like you see this a lot in sprinters, track and field?
It's a great question. Not so much like Achilles blowouts, you mean?
Yeah.
Not really.
Tendinopathies,
tendinitis. Yeah, tendinitis for sure. Plantar fasciitis for sure. But I haven't seen a lot of Achilles ruptures in sprinters.
I'm trying to think of why there would be a rapid dorsiflexion in any track and field.
You know, like I'm thinking more of just like trunk angle position. Like I feel like most of them happen in like acceleration when they're like really bent over.
Yeah.
Correct? Whereas like track and field, like, you know, they're in the blocks.
Yeah.
They're in the blocks and then five steps, they're upright.
I feel like,
you know, so I don't know. Maybe that has something to do with it. Just like the angle of the trunk position and the team sports, like they get into that like bent over.
It's like the rock back and then the takeoff or landing on it in a change of direction.
But I feel like those athletes, they tend to be, you know, a lot trimmer, right? And I feel like they're always stretching. They're always doing the right thing. Like, when was the last time you saw a basketball player stretch?
Yeah, basketball.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I say it all the time. Like, they're so explosive.
Right.
I mean, that's just evidence that we don't need to overstretch our patients or clients. That is an interesting point. Like, track and field athletes, what kind of footwear are they in compared to football, basketball, right? Like, I mean, they're more proprioceptive, right? Their foot's practically on the ground.
Right.
As opposed to a cleat or a basketball sneaker.
Yeah. And I think most track and field people are toe runners, right? They're not heel to toe. Right. Everybody, you know, football players and basketball players tend to be a lot of the heel toe. So if you're just bouncing, you know, toe to ball, foot, ball, foot, ball, foot, that Achilles isn't stretching that much.
It's a great point. Devontae Smith does that. Oh, you gotta watch his footwork, man. His heel never touches the ground.
You're right.
Like, I think he changed direction. His heel, like, maybe touched like the spindle of grass, but he's amazing. But you're right. Like, cause you're going linear.
Yeah.
You know, even if there's change of direction, that if there's no rapid dorsiflexion, the heel's not coming down, you stay on your toes. You know, as Kevin Clark would say, ground contact time. Mm-hmm. So.
Now, like, we're talking a lot about the athletes are, like, too strong, too big, too explosive. You know, would you shy away from, like, direct calf raises or from a preventative standpoint? You know, I'm just thinking early on, it's like, all right, like, if we want to help prevent it, maybe we should try to strengthen the tendon and the muscles around it. But down, like, the flip side of it is like, oh, well, these guys are too big. Or is it just, like, kind of a freak thing and we can't really strength? I guess my question is, like, do we need to strengthen the calf muscles? Yes or no?
I think you do, but I think you have to be conservative with it, so to speak, right? You don't need them having 24-inch calf muscles, because the muscle will get bigger, but that tendon's not getting any bigger, right? So if that muscle is so strong that it's just pulling, that tendon's going to be the weakest point in some instance. So if I think doing the calf raises are fine. You don't need to overdo it.
Right. Like, I'm just thinking from, like, a preventative standpoint. Yeah,
I mean, stuff, right? Like, I know you're asking, like, questions to get a conversation. I agree with you. Like, we have to retrain train the tendon on how to tolerate load rapidly, right? So, like, doing heel raises is great. Like, doing a squat is not going to make you jump higher. What's going to make you jump higher? Jumping. Right.
Yeah.
So I think the right answer is doing, like, we would call them prime times. Shout out to Deion Sanders. Like, hitting your toes on the ground as you're getting that rapid dorsiflexion. We would walk on our toes at the end of our training sessions with Dr. Ken Clark, where we'd be take the weight onto your toe and then let the heel drop down and then take off, come up, and then you're onto the next foot. So you're retraining the tendon how to tolerate a load and then explode out of that position. Bounding, running, skipping, all those things involve landing on a toe, going into dorsiflexion, coming out. So you can do heel raises, but that's not going to make it, I don't think it's going to protect the Achilles as much. And I agree. Now you got a lot of force through the gas rock and a lot of strength through the gas rock without, the tendon tolerance. What do you think about that?
Right? Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think it's not always like the calf's fault.
Yeah, I agree.
It's like not just like a weak calf or a super strong calf that's causing a lot of these things. There's a lot of other mechanisms.
A lot of other mechanics behind it.
Right, correct. You know, obviously a lot of the soft tissue range of motion stuff we already talked about, but just wanted to touch on, like, is it because someone's weak or strong?
I think it's because the tendon's not trained on doing that. If you haven't jumped rope in 20 years, don't go jump rope. You're going to be on your toe and then your heel's going to hit the ground. You're not used to that kind of motion, right? Yeah. So, like,
or it's not even a matter, don't do it. Just don't think you can do 50 jump ropes in a row. Like, start off easy. Like, do like 5 or 10, do it slow and then build up. Just like running a 4 or 5K or whatever, playing pickleball. Like, don't go play 3 games of pickleball if you've never played pickleball.
Yeah. Or try and dunk on a rim. Like, I mean, that's like the one rep max that's going to come back to bite you. But you're right. Like, the overload, issue is a concern as well. That's the last question I have on the whole thing is, what proximally can we do to help mitigate the risk of these types of injuries? Meaning, like, hips, core, planks, side planks, right? Like, I'll start with that one, and then
that's the one thing I was thinking of the whole time was, like, these happen when, like, the leg is behind the body, right? So, like, they're probably lacking some hip extension. So if they're lacking hip extension, pelvis is going to dump anteriorly. And the pelvis is going to dump anteriorly. The whole hamstrings calf complex is going to be put on more stress than it already is. And now you apply high force with a big body. So I kind of come back to, like, let's take a look at the hips, try to control the hips as much as possible. Teach athletes to, know how to extend and anteriorly tilt and know how to go the opposite way. Make sure we have adequate hip range of motion to be able to get into those positions. And I feel like you're going to help potentially hold back on some of those injuries.
Great point.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. I think a lot too is just going back to the stretching, like stretching your posterior chain, right? So core is always important. But then if your posterior chain is loose, you're less likely to have obviously a tight Achilles and then less likely to have a rupture. So working on that, I think, would be important.
Yeah. Amen. That's everything I got. Do you guys got anything else you want to add?
No.
Dr. Sundar, what's the best way for our listeners to find you? LinkedIn, Instagram.
Oh, wow.
TikTok.
Yeah, I have a LinkedIn account. I don't really, social media, I don't do a whole heck of a lot on, you know what I mean? Healthmark, we do have a Facebook account. So like you can always see us there. Our Healthmark website, and you just, you know, Google each of our names and we should pop up pretty easily as well. Again, we're local, so.
All right, awesome. Check out the show notes for the details on how to access the website. Contact Dr. Steven Sundar. Thanks for joining us, man. This has been
thanks
awesome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Yeah.
That's a wrap.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the On Cue Performance Therapy Podcast. If you'd like this episode, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It would mean so much to me if you could leave us a 5-star review so more listeners like you could get this important information. See you next time.